who will fight. We need room for another 300 if no one else comes from the city.
Any sign of General Danavis or Commander Ironfist? Gavin asked.
No, sir. Lord Prism, sir.
So it is fine, Gavin said. Blackguards, any of you who can draft without breaking the halo, help me. We'll make one more barge while we wait.
Wait, sir?
A blackguard asked. General Danavis is coming. We finish one more barge, then we go. He'll be here by then. A trumpet sounded. The pale Hrothgari shouted,
Enemies coming! Ready!
Can you hold while we make a barge? Gavin asked. The man was still small, still mousy, but his face was resolute, and anything comical about his appearance was gone.
We'll hold, sir, to the last man.
Chapter 90 Kerys selected one of the Merriman's horses that looked like it still had some wind and spirit left. Its barding was mirrored, and it shone in the morning sun. She might as well paint a target on her back. Well, she wasn't exactly inconspicuous herself. They didn't have long. The 400 paces between Lord Omnicrome's colour whites could only be crossed through a maze of alleys or rubble-strewn streets. It would slow them, but not much. Some things, though, had to be done. Kerys moved to check King Haradul's body, gritting her teeth against the gore. He was definitely dead. She felt a peculiar emptiness. She'd wanted him dead. He deserved it. Now he was just gone, and, quite possibly, it hadn't accomplished anything. She saw her bichoir on the ground next to him. Son of a bitch. She picked it up and scanned the ground, but there was no sight of her Atagan. No more time. Corvin Danavis's men were finishing collecting gunpowder and shot or replacement weapons from the dead and forming back up. Kip looked as bad as Kerys would have expected. Corvin said,
It's called being lightsick, Kip, and it might do anything to you. Make you feel weak as a puppy or strong as a sea demon. I've seen modest men tear off all their clothes because they couldn't bear anything touching their skin. And shy women, well, never mind.
Hey, that was just the one time, Kerys protested, mounting up.
When you could, it was good not to let a drafter sink too deep into themselves after drafting too much. Corvin laughed.
I don't know that I'd call you shy on any day, Kerys Whiteoak.
He glanced down at her leg.
Certainly not today.
Kerys followed Corvin's eyes. Oops. She had managed to tear the slit in her dress practically to her hip, and sitting on a horse didn't help. Well, what was she going to do? Go change?
Time's up, Corvin shouted to his men. We head for the docks. Catch up or die.
One of his officers came to him with a question, and he was swallowed up by his duties, which left Kerys with Kip. She would prefer to be unencumbered during a battle, but she wasn't going to abandon him. Not again. There were things more important than her freedom. She sidled her horse over to the platform.
Come here, Kip, she said with a little more edge than she meant.
Obviously dazed, Kip clambered up, and they were off. At first, Kerys thought they were going to get away cleanly. They came to the bridge. The far end was blocked with wagons and carts that must have just been set on fire moments before Corvin's men arrived, or they would have seen the smoke. The men at the front of the column skidded to a stop, and the men who'd been running behind them collided with them, collapsing the column and causing chaos. Corvin, mounted near the front, was trying to extricate some drafters from the crush to get them to work on clearing the flaming barricades. It would only take a minute or two in normal circumstances. Near to the back of the column, Kerys pulled up sharply and started shouting at the men near her to form a rear guard.
Load muskets! Affix matches!
She wheeled around in time to see the first of the colour whites pursuing them. Kerys had never seen anything like it. She'd known green whites could change their joints to give their legs immense springiness, but the greens weren't the only colour whites leaping from roof to roof behind them. A yellow white, limbs all aglow, ran straight toward the edge of a flat roof, gathering Luxin in both hands. She leapt off the edge and threw her hands down, releasing a jet of yellow at the ground, using the recoil to throw her up high enough to make it to the next roof, like she was playing leapfrog in midair. A flash of green, much closer. Kerys shot a ball of green up, intercepting the green-white as it descended. Her shot blasted the green-white off its trajectory, lifting it so that instead of landing among the terrified soldiers, it collided with the side of a building. The soldiers around it recovered before the white did. Carys heard a rattle of musket fire. Damn! Veterans would have dispatched it with their blades, saving precious shots for more active enemies. Another green-white streaked through the air and Carys missed it. It crashed through the back ranks, scattering men. Others, terrified, leveled their muskets and fired, most of them missing the white and hitting their own friends. By the time they put that one down, whites of every color were converging on them. Lord Omnichrome's army was rounding a corner, not 300 paces away, jogging, picking up speed for a charge. Half a dozen of Omnichrome's red and sub-red drafters were mounted. They closed within 200 paces and lobbed great flaming missiles toward Corvin's massed, trapped men. A blue-white, all glittering angles and blades, was the next across the rooftops to the left. A sub-red was leaping across roofs on the right, bald, her whole body literally aflame. Out of nowhere, a big drafter dropped into the street straight in front of Carys, his back to Corvin's men. He stood, arms spread out as if he were holding ropes and expecting a heavy load. His arms snapped out just as the blue-white and sub-red-white leapt to attack. Both color whites jerked hard as the invisible superviolet Luxin ropes around their necks went taut. The blue-white's body went abruptly horizontal, all the Luxin it had held going to jelly in an instant as it lost concentration. It crashed to the ground in front of the rearguard. The sub-red-white, without the benefit of blue armor around her neck, barely changed directions. Her body landed on the next roof and fell, and her flaming head rolled right into the river. The drafter who'd saved them shot a glance back, making sure the color whites were dead. It took Carys's breath away. It was Usef Tep, the Purple Bear himself, the hero of the False Prism's War. Even as Carys registered the fact, she saw the flaming missiles that were arcing toward the rear guard suddenly veer left and right in the air, exploding at a safe distance. Another green-white she hadn't even seen crashed into the ground, riddled with blue Luxin knives. Carys saw Elilef Korzin, skin luminous blue, step out of an alley.
"We've got your backs! Go!"
a woman yelled. Carys turned to see at least a dozen drafters stand on the last rooftop. It was like Carys had stepped into a hero's gallery. The woman who'd yelled was Samilla Sae. Didi Fallingleaf stood next to her, skin wrapped in vines of pure green Luxin. Flamehands stood on the corner of the building, a steady stream of fireballs popping from each hand. Sisters Tala and Tera to the right. Talon Gim bleeding heavily, left arm useless, but going to stand beside Usef Tep in the street. And others that Carys recognized from her youth, or who'd fought for Dazen, and whom she'd heard described in vivid detail.
"Damn you! You and that boy are the only ones who can save Gavin! Take him and get the hell out of here!"
Samilla Sae yelled, her eyes flashing. Corvin's men surged as the barricades gave way. Carys felt Kip stirring behind her. Lord Omnichrome's army was like an onrushing tide. Carys spurred her horse on, only shooting glances back at the magical conflagration behind her. It was enough. All of Corvin's men made it over the bridge. From there, it was a straight, adrenaline-fueled shot to the docks. Carys made it with the last group. Corvin, up at the front, was moving toward Gavin down on the docks. Gavin was working, drafting barges, it looked like. Someone alerted Gavin, and Carys saw a flash of his crooked smile toward Corvin. And in that moment, Carys knew. It was like she'd been clubbed. Her throat tightened. The pieces spun together. 1,000 pieces from the past 16 years, and the last few in the past few days. That grin, patting Corvin's shoulder on the wall this morning. If Carys hadn't spent more than a decade in the Blackguard, she wouldn't have caught it. But Gavin and Corvin should hate each other. That could be explained away. They were professionals, sure. They had reasons to work together, right, but seamless command and instant obedience come only with time and trust. How could these men trust each other? Who comes back from war a better man? Gavin had said, "What's in that note, it isn't true. I swear it isn't true." Why would Gavin double down on a lie that he knew was going to be exposed minutes later? Because it wasn't a lie. Oh, shit.
Chapter 91. Shaken from his torpor by Carys dismounting,
Kip looked from one side to the other, squinting, head pounding. One moment he'd been holding on to the woman, more concerned that as he clung to her, his arms were touching her breasts and she was going to think he was groping her, than worried about the exploding guns and coruscating magic. He was, by any rational account, a moron. And then, abruptly, they were at the docks. Kip couldn't follow things well. At first the men were challenging Corvin, and then welcoming him, and Corvin was giving orders and disappearing into the men, talking with this person and that. Kip felt simultaneously dizzy and as strong as a bear. Carys cursed aloud, but he didn't understand why. She pulled at his arms, still clamped around her waist. He released her and almost fell when she slipped out of the saddle. "I'll be back for you in a little while," Carys patted his arm. Suddenly her face came into tight focus, like he was looking through her, like he was understanding her. She looked vulnerable. Vulnerable? Carys White Oak? At another time, Kip would have laughed at the thought. Now his focus was too great. Her arms were tight. Some of that was concern for Kip, but that pat of his forearm was a "you'll be fine in a little while" pat. She wasn't worried about Kip. She was nervous about something else. Carys turned and Kip saw her square her shoulders. Her shoulders lifted. She was taking a deep breath. Then she strode down the dock as if she were as confident as always in between soldiers, drafters, sailors, and scared civilians. Despite the bustle and the nerves and the not-so-distant fighting, the crowd parted for this vision of war and beauty, knotted muscles and femininity, the Luxin sword on her back still smoking, soot on her naked shoulders and cleavage, a clawed bichoir in her fist, barefoot, black hair wind-blown, her stride fearless. She stopped behind a copper-haired drafter who was working on a great barge, spoke. The man's head whipped around like it was on a swivel, not just any man. The prism. Gavin swept Carys into a huge hug immediately. Relief. Carys's body was stiff, her arms still at her sides, either shocked or repulsed, Kip couldn't tell. Then, slowly, the stiffness in her arms and shoulders seemed to melt by degrees. Her arms were moving, coming up to Gavin's back to return the embrace. Then Gavin saw Kip. Surprise. He released Carys, said something. Carys's open hand cracked across Gavin's cheek. Gavin's hands turned up. What did I say? But Carys was storming off, not answering. Gavin looked from her to Kip, to the unfinished barge behind him, threw his hands down. Kip could swear he heard the curse all the way from here. He wanted to shrink into himself. It was like he'd just seen his parents fighting. All he wanted was to be gone. He turned toward the city. His vision was still intensely focusing on one thing at a time, losing the holes for the parts. The light sickness. He knew it was an army there in front of him, but he only saw this man checking the fuse on his matchlock, this one with half of his moustache burned off, fiddling with his musket's ramrod, spinning it in its rest. This man with his plug bayonet out, using it as a back scratcher and joking with his comrades as if he were totally unafraid, while his tight, dead eyes told otherwise. This man talking non-stop while no one paid him any attention. Kip looked over empty slips at the dock. Not a single ship left. Even the smallest dory was gone. Almost on the dock, parallel to theirs, he saw a huge, swarthy man chased down and surrounded by a dozen mirrormen. Something defiant was written in the man's stance, but the mirrormen had muskets on him from every angle. Iron Fist. "Have I gone mad, or is that Commander Iron Fist?" Kip asked.
"Sir?"
a man standing next to Kip's horse asked.
"Move!" Kip shouted. "Move!"
With a few curses, the men parted for him.
"Kip, what are you doing?"
Corvin Danavis shouted. From his angle, he couldn't see Iron Fist. Kip barely heard him. He dug his heels into the horse and held on for dear life. Breaking free of hundreds of nervous men, the horse ran. Kip was tossed around like a sack of pomegranates being crushed to juice and seeds. The horse galloped along the edge of the docks, going in the right general direction, but it wasn't slowing down. Kip pulled hard on the reins, but the horse had its bit in its teeth, and it wasn't letting go. The mirrormen saw Kip coming and yelled. A few had time to discharge shots. Kip swore a musket ball licked his ear with a hot tongue.
"I am the stupidest person I've ever met,"
As the horse streaked toward Iron Fist and his captors, still not slowing, Kip kicked his feet free of the stirrups and jumped out of the saddle, diving for the mirror men. Whatever he'd done before with all the green Luxin that had cushioned everything, this time he didn't do it. He missed the mirror men and hit the ground hard, flipping over and over, smacking his cracked, burned left hand hard against something. It felt like fire traced through every joint in his hand. He smacked his head, skidded on his back, clothes tangling him up, and tried to stand. He was facing the city. There was no one that direction. He turned toward Commander Iron Fist, got his feet tangled, fell, caught himself with his left hand. Tears sprang out of his eyes unbidden, agony.
"No!"
Iron Fist screamed. Kip was tottering on one knee, dizzy, propped up only by his shrieking left hand. He wanted to fall on his back, show these men he wasn't a threat, beg them not to hurt him. "I spend more time on my back than a rent girl." "Enough!" One of the men had his bayonet fixed. He was stepping toward Kip. Kip pushed himself up, off his left hand. The fire of pain shot up his arm. Kip just pointed his ruined left hand at the mirror man and made that fire shoot back down, propping himself up on his good hand. Flame roared out and engulfed the man. He baked, his mirror armor useless. Staggering to his feet, Kip threw more and more fire into the guards, and then he found out why Corvin had said he wouldn't want to draft for a month when you were lightsick. His stomach boiled. He puked. He couldn't keep his feet. The dizziness and nausea dropped him like he'd been cut off at the knees. His stomach cramped so hard he bent in half, curling into a fetal position, still puking, splattering vomit on his own pants. Once again, Kip, the charging white knight, manages to do nothing. He was dead. He knew he had to be dead. The men had been charging at him, and he'd killed at least one of them. They should have killed him by now.
"Let go of the rest of the Luxin. It'll make you sick again, but it's better, I promise. Now, boy, I can't carry you and draft at the same time."
"Iron Fist?" Kip cracked his eyes open, saw dead men scattered around, and Iron Fist standing over him, his fists bearing spikes of bloodied blue Luxin. Iron Fist had cuts and dried blood and powder burns everywhere. He wore blue spectacles close to his eyes, the earpieces tied tight around the back of his head. His gotra had been knocked off his head, and his hair was singed on one side. How'd the man gotten away after commandeering a cannon? Surely the whole of King Haradul's army had fallen on him. Nonetheless, here he was, bruised, exhausted, injured, but not so hurt that he couldn't save Kip one more time.
"Now!" Iron Fist demanded. "I'm lightsick myself. I know what I'm asking."
Kip let go of the rest of the Luxin and threw up again, his insides heaving, all of his viscera trying to rush out of his mouth. But then, miraculously, he did feel better, almost able to stand. Iron Fist grabbed the shoulder of his shirt and lifted him bodily to his feet.
"Idiot boy, I did all this to save you and you nearly throw it away. What the hell were you thinking?"
But Kip was in no state to answer. He was staring at the army, back on the other dock. Or Hollum's balls. A full-scale battle was being waged just 200 paces away. Perhaps 100 soldiers and drafters were holding the dock against thousands of soldiers and dozens of drafters. The confined space was all that kept Gavin's men from being overwhelmed. The front lines were a mess of bayonets and swords, a few spears and hoes and scythes, and long-handled orange limb shears and magic being thrown and blocked each way. Behind the front lines, Gavin and some other drafters were just finishing the last barge, unable to join the fighting because their drafting talents were needed for shipbuilding. The mass of invaders was pushing Gavin's men steadily backward, their sheer weight unstoppable. To Kip it looked like they were already too late. And he was still sick, still dizzy, still feeling stronger than ever in his life, torn between wanting to lie down and feeling like he needed to go running or he would burn up.
"Follow me!"
Iron Fist said.
"Stay as close as you can. It doesn't float for long."
With no more explanation. Float? What was floating? Iron Fist ran straight off the side of the dock, one hand spraying blue Luxin out in a wide stream. Kip followed, charging down the slick surface, holding his pants tight in his left hand and praying he didn't fall. The blue path dove off the end of the dock steeply and then leveled out at the water, floating on top of the surface like a very unsteady boat.
"Keep running!"
Iron Fist said. In front of them, the defence was crumbling just as the great Luxin barge pushed off the dock. The last remnants of the defenders were trying to fight and retreat at the same time. Some turned and were cut down as they tried to run to make the jump to the barge. Others abandoned the idea of making it to the ship themselves and stood their ground. Lord Omnichrome's army, though, was so huge and had so much pent-up pressure that without 100 soldiers pushing it back, it burst down the dock, the men behind shoving the men in front of them so hard and so relentlessly that both defenders and the front lines of Lord Omnichrome's men were pushed straight off the edge of the dock. Dozens, perhaps 100 men and women splashed into the bay. We're not going to make it. There's nowhere for us to go. But Iron Fist merely turned his blue path over the waves out. By Orholm, they were going to run all the way out to the barge? Kip couldn't make it. He was too dizzy. It was too far.
Faster, Kip! Damn you, faster!
Iron Fist shouted. Water jumped up into the air to their right. Kip glanced that way, saw nothing, found himself running right along the edge of the blue path, almost falling in the water, and curved back. More water jumped to each side of them. They're shooting at us. Lungs heaving, head swimming. In front of them, Kip saw magic, setting the air alight between the barge and the dock. Gavin was standing at the stern of the boat, throwing out great swaths of flame, darts, light grenades, a veritable artillery barrage of chromaturgy. A space cleared around him on the barge as everyone else shrank back, stunned, awed, afraid of anyone who could handle so much magic. Gavin was fighting all the drafters on the dock, by himself, and winning. That's my father. I can't let him down. I've screwed up everything else. I'm going to get to that damned boat.
I can't keep this up,
Iron Fist shouted, his voice strained.
I've got to make it narrower, Kip, or we won't make it.
Do it, Kip yelled. The platform abruptly shrank to barely 3 hands' breadths wide. It sank into the water even as Kip ran across it, his feet splashing water, but they had only 30 paces to go. The path started arching up, out of the water to attach to the side of the barge, out of the way of all the magic going back and forth. Kip looked up at Gavin and saw that someone had stepped into the empty circle behind the prism. Though the boy wore peasant's garb, Kip recognized him instantly. Simon. Simon had snuck onto the barge with the rest of the refugees, and he was holding a box, Kip's box, the last thing Kip's mother had ever given him, the only thing she'd ever given him. Gavin was still hurling magic and deflecting magic. Everyone was either watching him or had crowded to the side of the barge and was watching Iron Fist and Kip come in. Iron Fist was looking down at the path he was drafting, intent on the magic. Kip was the only person who saw a gleaming knife come out of that box. Kip's next step missed the narrow Luxin platform. He plunged hard into the water. Clumsy Kip. Stupid Kip. His huge splash would make even more of a distraction for Simon to take advantage of. Lord Omnichrome had sent Simon to assassinate Gavin. Kip had seen it, and he'd decided to go somewhere else. He'd had a dozen chances to do the right thing, and he'd missed them all. Even 5 minutes ago, if he hadn't gone after Iron Fist, he would have been on the barge. He could have stopped Simon. Kip wouldn't fail again. He refused. He threw his hands down, opened his eyes despite the water, and started sucking in light. It hurt like hell. He didn't care. He sucked it in like he was the mouth of one of Gavin's great skimmer engines, and threw it down. He shot out of the water, by Orholm's own hand, or by all the luck that had gone against him for his whole life, now finally reversing course, he shot in the right direction. He flew onto the barge's deck, blasting through 6 people gathered at the railing looking for him, and he kept his feet, though he was at a crazy angle and had to run as fast as he could just to not fall down. He burst into the opening around Gavin just as Simon closed on the prism. Simon sank the great white dagger into Gavin's back an instant before Kip collided with him, the top of Kip's head smashing Simon's nose. His momentum carried them both off the opposite side of the barge. They landed with a great splash. Kip got a breath before they went under and immediately began tearing at Simon, punching him, ripping at the dagger in his one hand and the sheath in the other. Simon hadn't taken a breath. He let both go and flailed, trying to get away from Kip with panicky motions. Kip tried to slash the other boy still underwater and missed. With a gasp, Kip surfaced. Simon surfaced 5 paces away, blood streaming from his broken nose, staining the water. Kip heard screams beyond Simon. The sharks had come,
and were turning the water between Zymon and the docks to white froth in the frenzy.
"Kip! Grab the rope! Grab the rope!"
someone shouted. A coil hit the water close to him. Zymon gave Kip one hateful glance and started swimming for shore. He was a good swimmer, too, faster than Kip. It would be madness to go after him. And he was bleeding.
"Kip!"
Kip felt the first tremor of light sickness hitting him. Oh, shit. But he'd lost his dagger before. It was everything. He wouldn't lose it again. Bobbing in the waves, trying to ignore at least another score of triangular fins, cutting the water headed for the dock, he sheathed the blade and tucked it inside his pants, and only then did he grab the rope. Good thing there was a loop on the end. Kip managed to pull it over his head before he threw up the first time. There was nothing in his stomach, so he dry-heaved as the barge towed him along for a way until the men on deck could haul him out of the water. "Let go of the rest of the Luxin, Kip," someone was saying to him.
"I can't. I can't."
He knew it was going to be bad. He couldn't take any more pain. He couldn't even open his eyes.
"Come on, Kip. Do it for me," Gavin said gently.
Kip let go of the last of the Luxin. The last thing he was aware of was pain shooting through his head. Lances of light blotting out darkness, only to leave more behind. Chapter 92. The prisoner was full in fever's grip. The gash he'd cut across his chest and the foul hair he'd packed into the cut had done their work. Death or freedom. It was time. He tried to stand, but couldn't. He was shaking too hard. Maybe he'd waited too long. He'd wanted, needed to wait until the fever was at its hottest in order to have any chance at all. If he'd miscalculated, he would simply die and end all of Dazen's problems for him. That would just be tragic. He propped himself up, found his dirty little hair bowl close at hand, tried to inspect it for flaws for the thousandth time. He couldn't tell. He felt like weeping, the fever throwing his very emotions into disarray.
"I'm sorry, Dazen. I failed you," he said aloud.
Meaningless words. From nowhere. The part of him that had marinated in blue for so many years found that curious. Not unexpected, but still strange. Why should he feel emotions simply because his blood was literally hotter than normal? Strange, but inconsequential. He pulled the cut on his chest open, pulled out the chunky, dirty, blood-clotted wad of filth and threw it aside. It didn't all come out together, some was stuck in the wound. With a grimy fingernail, he scratched out the remaining filth. It made him gag with pain. Stupidity. He'd use his fingernail? When trying to clean a wound? He should have drafted tweezers. He wasn't thinking straight. He blinked, his body tottering. No, there was no failure. Lesser men might fail, not him, not without trying his plan. Gavin scooted over to the shallow bowl he'd scraped with his own hands over the course of 16 years. Well, some men might have nothing to show for 16 years of labor. He laughed aloud. The dead man in the wall looked concerned. "Keep it together, Dazen. Gavin. Whatever. Whoever you are, today you're a prisoner. Today you can be a free man. Or a dead man. Which is a freedom of its own, isn't it?" Dazen took his finely woven hair bowl and laid it inside the stone bowl he'd dug over the years. It fit perfectly, as well it might. He'd made it to fit, and checked it 1,000 times as he crafted it. Sitting right in front of the bowl and its depression, Dazen untied his loincloth and shifted awkwardly until he could set it aside. "If only Caris could see us now, huh?" the dead man said. "How could she choose him over this?" Dazen barely glanced at the dead man, sitting in his shiny blue wall, mocking him, seated with legs spread grotesquely in front of a hair bowl and a shallow hole. "You can't debase me," Dazen told the dead man. "I do what I must. If that's depravity, so be it." He licked dry lips. He hadn't been drinking water. He needed to be nearly dehydrated for this. His tongue felt thick. The dead man said something in response, but Dazen ignored him. For a moment he forgot what was next. He needed to make water. He wanted to lie down. Orholm, he was tired. If only he could rest, he'd have the strength. Slapping. That was what was next. A little more pain and then freedom, Dazen. A little more. You're a guile. You can't be chained like this. You're the prison. You've been wronged. The world needs to know your vengeance. Seated, still, there was no reason to move from here. He wouldn't be able to make it back if he moved. He studied every surface of his body that was visible. Then he started slapping himself. Everywhere that he would be able to see. Hard. "This strikes you as rational?" the dead man asked. "Maybe 16 years in blue hasn't been enough for you." Gavin, Dazen, damn it, ignored him. He slapped his forearms, his stomach, his chest, everywhere except where the cut was. He didn't want to pass out this close to victory. And his legs. Every surface of his body that he could see, he slapped until it was insensitive, numb to the pain, and, more important, red. Gavin was only human. Though he was a super-chromat, even he made tiny errors. That was Dazen's bet. That was why Gavin hadn't let anything with color down here. If he'd made the blue light perfectly, all in only one incredibly tight spectrum, there would have been only blue light to reflect from any item. Gavin wouldn't have had to worry, even if his prisoner had red or green or yellow spectacles. But the tiny flash of green Dazen saw every time he pissed into his bowl before it was leached of color told him that there was some spectrum bleed. Now everything depended on how much and how fast he could draft. Shivering, trembling hard from fever and from beating his skin nearly bloody, he pissed. Not straight into the depression, not straight into the hairball. If he pissed too hard, he was worried he'd break right through the oil that he'd so painstakingly smeared around the inside of the hairball. So he pissed into his hand and let the warm liquid flow gently into the hairball. "You've made me an animal, brother." But if animal he was, Dazen was a fox. The dehydration had made his urine as shockingly yellow as his body could produce, and the woven, oiled hair bowl held. Dazen's heart leapt. He wanted to weep, as he saw yellow for the first time in 16 years. Yellow! There was spectrum bleed. By your holum, it was beautiful. He drafted off of it. Just a tiny amount. It was like trying to suck water through a bag, even as the bowl slowly drained. He drafted a yellow ball, not even as big as his thumb, into the palm of his left hand. It immediately started shimmering into light, but yellow light. For the first time, Dazen saw his cell in something other than blue light. He saw his body in something other than blue light. And yellow, being in the middle of the spectrum rather than at the opposite end, made red a hell of a lot easier to see. And it had spectrum bleed both up and down. And Dazen's whole body was red from him slapping it. Dazen drafted red hard as he could, even as the little yellow marble sputtered out and disappeared. It was enough. It had to be enough. The skin down to his right arm looked dull in the blue light that once again dominated the cell, but he knew it was red, and now the whole reason he'd given himself a fever. Dazen drafted heat from his own body. It was incredibly inefficient. It had never worked before. He was shaking. The fever was so bad he couldn't think. Surely, surely, he drew on his body's heat, tried to imagine it rising in waves as from a desert. A tiny flame, a spark, was all he needed. He had as much as he could get. Like an old man, Dazen propped himself up. Magic had weight. And with as much as he was planning to throw, he needed to not fall over as soon as he started. He got up to his knees and grinned at the dead man. The dead man grinned back, like he'd been expecting this, like he'd been waiting for it for years. Dazen brought his hands together. He threw a tiny starter stream of red out of his right hand directly at the dead man's face. His left hand let all the heat he'd gathered go at once, and made a tiny spark. The spark caught. The red blazed, and suddenly the blue cell was flooded with red light and heat. Dazen drafted more and more and released it in a hammer blow straight at the dead man, straight at the weak spot in the cell wall. The concussion bowled him over despite his attempt to brace himself. He'd thrown his fireball with so much will there'd been no way he could take the force in his weakened body. He didn't think he lost consciousness, but when he opened his eyes, the world was still blue. Failure. Dear Orholum, no. Dazen rolled over, expecting to see the dead man leering at him, but the dead man was gone. A hole stood in his place, jagged, broken in the wall,
the edges smouldering, glowing with sludgy, low-burning red luxin, a hole, and a tunnel beyond. He couldn't stop himself. Dazen started weeping. Freedom. He couldn't stand. He was too weak, but he knew he had to get out. He had to go as far as he could from here before Gavin discovered he was gone, so he started crawling. As he crossed out of the blue Luxin cell, he held his breath, sure there would be some trap or some alarm. Nothing. He breathed deep, fresh, clean air filling his lungs with strength, and began crawling to freedom.
Chapter 93 Kip woke in a little blue room. Every surface was blue Luxin, even the pallet where he was sleeping, though it had been softened with a heap of blankets. From the faint rocking motion he realized he was on one of the blue barges. And his back hurt like hell. In fact, most of his body hurt. His left hand was bandaged heavily, and he could feel that a thick poultice had been spread all over it. His shoulders and both arms were bruised everywhere. He felt like someone had beaten both of his legs with a board. His head was throbbing, and he was sore pretty much any other place on his body he could think of. He wiggled a pinky toe. Yeah, that was sore too. And he was hungry. Unbelievable. You're on a refugee ship, Kip. There ain't gonna be any food. He tried to go back to sleep. That was the best thing for it. He'd feel better when he woke up, and they might catch some fish or something by then. He rolled over and his lower back still hurt. What the... He shifted and realized he was lying on something. Reaching down to his waistband, his fingers brushed something. His eyes shot open. The knife. His inheritance. If it didn't hurt so bad, he would have laughed about it. Clearly, he'd been carried in here wrapped in blankets and left. No one had even noticed. In an armada of ships with thousands of refugees and soldiers and maybe 100 boats, with pirates and everything else to worry about, apparently Kip hadn't been the first thing on Gavin's mind. Well, what did I expect? They couldn't strip me and get me dry clothes. There are no dry clothes. Kip rolled off the knife and sat up. He groaned. He really was sore. And hungry. But that didn't matter now. A figure passed the door, and Kip hid the knife by his leg hurriedly. Gavin poked his head in. You're awake, he said. How do you feel?
Like an elephant sat on me, Kip said.
Gavin grinned and came and sat on the edge of Kip's pallet.
I heard you were trying to be Iron Fist for a while out there. He's pretty steamed. He's supposed to be the one who saves my life, you know.
He's mad?
Kip asked, worried.
Gavin sobered. No, Kip. No one's mad at you. He won't admit it, but he's proud of you.
He is.
And I am too.
I thought I was too late.
Gavin was proud of him. His mind couldn't really register the thought. His mother had always been ashamed of him, and the prism himself was proud?
Kip blinked quickly, looked away.
You're really fine?
Kip asked.
Gavin smiled. Never felt better, he said. Oh, did you know that boy?
The assassin?
Kip felt a lump in his throat.
He was one of the drafters who wiped out Recton. Simon was his name.
He tried to kill me there.
Did he get eaten?
Kip remembered the boy bleeding profusely, swimming toward all those sharks.
I don't know, Gavin said. My rule is, if you don't see an enemy dead with your own eyes, assume they're still alive.
He grinned, almost grimly, at a private thought.
But, he said, shaking himself out of it, I guess that explains this.
He pulled out the rosewood box that had held Kip's dagger. Gavin handed it to Kip.
It's empty, he said. But I thought it looked like that box your mother tried to give you. Either your Zymon stole it from King Haradul, or this is a common style.
Looks like it held a knife. But I guess that went into the waves. I'm sorry. Kip wanted to rush to confess, but the knife was his. Gavin might take it away from him. Kip hadn't even gotten to see it yet. Not really.
Anyway, Gavin said, you rest up, I've got work to do. I'll have someone send in some food to you and we'll talk later, all right?
He got up, stopped at the door.
Thank you, Kip. You saved my life, son.
Well done.
I'm proud of you.
Son. Son.
There was pride in Gavin's voice as he said it. Kip had made the prism proud. It was like light bursting over hills to illuminate places in his soul that had never seen it. The lump in his throat grew huge, his eyes filled with tears. Gavin turned to go.
Wait! Father, wait!
Kip froze, as did Gavin, outlined in the door. The last time Kip had used the word, he was being a snot and things hadn't gone well. And then it got worse, as Kip suddenly realized Gavin had meant son, like young man. Kip wished he could go jump back into the water for the sharks.
I'm so sorry, he said. I didn't...
No, Gavin cut him off with a hand. Whatever else you did, you proved yourself a guile today, Kip. Kip licked his lips.
Did Caris? I saw her hit you. Was that because of me?
Gavin laughed gently. Kip, a woman is the mystery you'll never stop investigating. Kip paused.
Is that a yes?
Caris hit me because I needed hitting. That didn't really help. Get some sleep, son, Gavin said. He paused, as if he was tasting the word. We're done with that nephew nonsense. The world will know you're my son. And to hell with the consequences. A little reckless grin, and then he was gone. Kip didn't sleep. He propped his back against one blue wall and pulled out the dagger. The blade was a dazzling, strange white metal with a spiraling cord of black threaded from point to hilt. There was little ornamentation except for 7 clear, perfect diamonds on the hilt. Well, 6 diamonds and maybe a sapphire. Kip didn't really know his jewels, but 6 stones were clear as glass, but brilliantly refractive. The 7th matched the others in size and clarity, but it glowed, a brilliant, magical blue. Kip sheathed the dagger. How did my mother get such a thing? How did she not pawn it for Hayes? Kip opened the rosewood box to put the dagger away, and with his bandaged left hand he fumbled it, dropping it upside down in his lap. He turned it over and saw that the silk lining was loose, not attached to the box itself, but to a frame that filled the box. He pulled on the frame, lifting it out. Underneath was a thin compartment that held extra laces that matched the color of the sheath to tie it to different sizes of belt. It wasn't a secret compartment, but obviously Zaimon hadn't noticed it. Nor had King Haradul, because there was a note there. With trepidation, glancing at the door to make sure no one was passing, Kip read the note, written in his mother's hard, deliberate strokes.
Kip, go to the Cromeria and kill the man who raped me and took away everything I had. Don't listen to his lies. Swear you won't fail me. If you ever loved me, if you've ever wanted to do anything good in this world, use this dagger to kill your father. Kill Gavin Guile.
Kip felt locked up, paralyzed. Someone was lying to him, betraying him. Kip felt those deep, sucking pools of rage stirring. It had to be his mother. Addict, whore, liar. Kip's mother would lie for Hayes. She would abandon Kip in a closet. Gavin had been hard on him, but he'd never lied to him. He never would. Never. He was Kip's family. The first Kip had ever had. But his mother had kept the dagger and even the box. She could have sold either for a mountain of Hayes. She would have thought of them every time the madness of craving had been on her. If this was more important to her than Hayes, why would she lie? Kip shivered, feeling like he was being ripped out of his moorings. He didn't know the truth. But he would. He swore it. He folded the note and saw a quick scribble on the back he'd missed before, written looser and faster than the rest, but undeniably in his mother's hand.
I love you, Kip. I always have.
She'd never said those words. Not once. Not in his whole life. He threw the note away like it was a serpent, pushed his face into the blankets so no one could hear, and bawled. Chapter 94. Dazen was crawling through darkness. This was death. But life lay beyond, somewhere. The floor was sharp, cutting his hands and knees cruelly.
He'd sucked up as much red luxon as he could before he'd left the blue cell, and if he hadn't been fevered, he would have kept a flame alive. But his thoughts were still sluggish, stupid. All he could do was hold on to his anger, and the red had helped him do that at first. "I will have my vengeance," he thought. But it was passionless. There was only the pain in his hands and knees and the crawling. He refused to stop. This tunnel had curved and curved again, but it couldn't go on forever. Soon he would sleep, and either die or wake stronger, strong enough to gather his strength and bring down Gavin. He laughed weakly and kept crawling. Damn this sharp rock. What has his brother done? Carved his prison out of pure hellstone? Son of a bitch. That was exactly what Gavin had done. Spent a fortune simply to cut Dazen up. The hateful bastard. But Dazen wasn't so easy to stop. He kept crawling. Freedom would not be denied him so easily. Still, obsidian was so rare that lining an entire tunnel with the stuff would have cost more than the Guile family made in a year. Why would Gavin have done such a thing? The magic properties of the stuff meant that with pure darkness and a direct connection, such as through blood or an open cut, it could drain the Luxon out of a drafter. No wonder the red Luxon wasn't helping Dazen feel hatred anymore. It had all been drained away. Something niggled at Dazen's mind. The bends in the tunnel, maybe that was it. The tunnels had bent so that no blue light would spill from the blue cell into the tunnel. Thus the tunnel would be totally dark, so the obsidian would work. Damn Gavin to the Evernight. He's not stopping me. I don't care if I'm a bloody wreck. I'm getting out of here. Part of Dazen was telling him to stop, to think. That blue, rational part of him, but he couldn't stop. If he didn't keep moving, he'd never get anywhere. He was so sick, so fevered, that if he stopped, he might never move again. Gavin wanted to paralyze him. No. No, no, no. Dazen pushed on. The floor here felt different, not obsidian. He'd gotten past it. He crawled farther. He could swear there was a glow ahead of him. Dear Orholm, there was... The floor dropped out from under him, swinging open on hidden hinges. Dazen tumbled down, rolling over and over, unable to stop himself, down a chute that snapped shut behind him. He rolled over, bathed in green light. Green? An entire round chamber, with green walls like trees. A hole up top for water and food and air, and a hole in the bottom for waste. Dazen looked desperately at his skin for the red Luxon. It was gone. All gone. All sucked up by the obsidian tunnel. Dazen started laughing stupidly, desperately, madly. A green prison, after the blue prison. He laughed until he was sobbing. There wasn't one prison. There weren't two. He knew it now. He had no doubt. There were seven prisons, one for every color. And in 16 years, he had only escaped the first. He laughed and sobbed. In one luminous green wall, the dead man laughed with him. At him.
Chapter 95.
Not bad for a defeat, said Corvin Danavis,
coming into Gavin's cabin. Gavin sat up, blinking the sleep from his eyes. His quick nap, after talking to Kip, had left him woolly. But he'd drafted so much over the past week, it was no wonder he felt off. He said, "We lost the city, 3/4 of the Blackguard, and hundreds if not thousands of soldiers. My natural son, whom I just acknowledged, publicly murdered a rightful satrap, which will make the other satraps worry I'm trying to rule the world again. We have thousands of refugees that we have to put Orholm knows where. There's some pagan army in charge of Garriston. And I've built them a damn near unassailable wall which will now protect my enemies. Oh, and your daughter has joined our foes. If that's not bad for a defeat, I'm not really sure what is."
"Could be worse," Corvin said.
Gavin rubbed his cheek where Karis had slapped him. "It was worse, Corvin," he wanted to say. He'd been so delighted to see Karis alive that he'd hugged her without thinking. He'd deserved the slap for that alone. But she'd clung to him for half a moment. Maybe she just felt relieved to be safe, away from King Haradul's army, but he'd hoped it was something more. Then she'd whispered, "I know your big secret, you asshole. Why couldn't you be man enough to tell me yourself?"
big secret? His heart froze up in his chest. Which big secret? She released him and stared into his eyes. Unable to take it, he glanced away and saw Kip. Kip, whom he thought was most likely dead. Like a moron, he said, Kip? He hadn't meant Kip was his big secret. That would be stupid. Of course she knew about Kip, but his brain wasn't working. Her closeness, the battle, the effects of his drafting so much, and the sudden sense of exposure throttled his thoughts. She'd slapped him. He'd deserved it. Gavin said to Corvin, It can always be worse. Is the weather holding? He sat up. If he had to make these barges weather a storm, he was going to have a lot of work to do.
Hold up, Corvin said. Your attitude when you go out there matters.
Gavin stopped. Corvin had talked to him like this before, but not since the war. What are you talking about?
I mean, this Lord Omnichrome doesn't care about Gaddiston. The only thing Gaddiston was to him was a chance to take a victory from us, and frame you for murdering a satrap so he could mobilize people to fight you. What he wants is to destroy the Cremeria. He wants to drive out the belief in Orhulam and set up a new order, and we don't even know what that new order is yet.
So let's rephrase defeat as crushing defeat, huh? Gavin knew he was being childish, but Corvin was the only person around whom he could complain. It felt good to have his friend back.
We have to get ready for war, Corvin said. A bigger war than over one little city.
You think people are going to join him?
In droves, Corvin said. My daughter did, and she's not stupid. So we have to believe he's charismatic. And we've already seen that he's smart enough to defeat us and get all he wants, so we have to look at what we have and prepare.
I'm sorry she joined him, Corvin. She seemed like such a sensible girl. I should have watched out for her better while she was—
She is a sensible girl. I'm not worried about her. She'll come back, Corvin said.
There was an edge on his voice, as well there should be. He was trying to convince himself, too. But Gavin knew not to push it. So what do we have? Gavin asked.
We have you and me. We got Karis back and Kip back and Iron Fist back, when we could have easily lost all three. We have the devotion, loyalty, awe, and motivation of 30,000 people who now believe in Gavin Guile to the core of their souls. I call that the start of an army. You're the prism. How is some pagan king going to stand up to you?
Gavin laughed, because both of them knew that there were about 1,000 ways. It was also a little scary how Corvin thought, how he saw through things. Gavin would have to be careful. There are things you can't tell even your best friend. Great purposes best achieved by misdirection. Pensive, Gavin said, You know, I came up with a list of things I want to accomplish before I die, and the best thing on that list was to free Gaddiston. What I let happen there after the war was—
I don't know if it's the worst thing I've done, that's a crowded field. But I let what was happening in Gaddiston keep happening. For 16 years. With all my power, I could never get the Spectrum to stop it.
I knew a man once who had a knack of changing the rules when he couldn't win. He didn't give up when others said he'd already lost, Corvin said. So, Gaddiston is a collection of ramshackle buildings with indefensible walls.
So I built new walls. I changed the rules. I tried, Corvin. I lost. Gavin grimaced, light dawning. Oh, and you're going to say next, you lost a collection of ramshackle buildings. And I'm going to say, yes, we've established that. And you're going to point out that when I decided to free Gaddiston, I probably wasn't worried about the misery of the buildings, but the misery of the people.
And then I'll point out that all those people you wanted to free are here. And then you'll admit my superior wisdom.
Gavin laughed. In some moments, it was like a day hadn't passed since they'd been separated. Well, we know one of those things isn't going to happen. Corvin grinned. He was right, though.
So, he said, go out there and smile and pat your soldiers on the back and act like an emperor with a great purpose before him, a Promarchos who will accomplish that great purpose. You have freed these people. You are going to protect them, and you will give them a new home. You will give them justice. And they're going to help you.
Sometimes I think you should have been the leader, not me, Gavin said.
Me too,
Corvin said. He grinned.
Orhulam's ways are mysterious. In some cases, very mysterious.
Thanks, Gavin said, Then they laughed together. It felt good. Food for a hungry soul.
By the by, how's your back? I could have sworn that little weasel stabbed you. Kip's being hailed as a hero for stopping him, you know.
He got him right in the nick of time, I guess, Gavin said, though he must have taken a shot in the kidney from the boy's fist as Kip had tackled him, because he had felt a searing pain. He pulled his shirt around and showed it to Corvin. The shirt was cut over his kidney, but his skin was unbroken.
A near thing, he said.
Corvin whistled.
Or Roland's hand must be on you, my friend.
Gavin grunted. From how his head felt, he wished Orholm's hand were a little gentler.
Well, time to go play Emperor, then, he said.
Together they walked to the door of the cabin. And who had drafted cabins onto the barge? Gavin paused. Corvin, something was bothering me.
Yes?
All those years you spent in that little town. Seems like an awful coincidence that both you and Kip were in the same place.
Not a coincidence, Corvin said soberly.
You tracked him down. You were looking out for him, watching him. Gavin didn't need Corvin to confirm it. He knew. But you never got very close to him.
Tried not to, anyway. He's a good boy. But he is who he is, Corvin said.
He meant he is your brother's son. Corvin looked down at his hands and lowered his voice, so that even if someone had been eavesdropping just outside the room, they couldn't have made out the words.
I knew you might need me to kill him someday. I didn't want to make it harder than it had to be.
Neither said anything for a long moment. The Danavis motto was fealty to one. Corvin didn't believe in Orholm, or the Cromeria, or any creed. He believed in Gavin. Sometimes it was frightening to have someone believe in you like that. For a second, Gavin considered telling Corvin his seventh and final purpose. Trusting him. But no. Safer this way. He'd tell him when the time came.
Some world, Corvin said finally.
Some day, Gavin said, looking out on the grey skies. Blah. Corvin grunted.
At least it's nice out, he said,
and went on his way. Sometimes Corvin's sarcasm was so deadpan. Gavin shrugged and went around patting shoulders, checking on the wounded, asking about supplies and their course, mostly being seen, and being seen to care and to be in charge. Kerris watched him the whole time, but never said a word to him. There was another problem he'd have to address. He checked in on Kip. The boy was curled up, asleep, as well he might be. Gavin was still sorting out the tales. According to the stories, Kip had drafted green, blue, red, and maybe yellow. At 15 years of age. Gavin had hoped to buy them both some time by falsifying the testing stone. Kip's road was going to be hard enough as it was. Too late now. Smart, brave, and now a polychrome, the boy had more than proven himself a guile. Gavin would have to work twice as hard to keep the truth from him. There was a lot of work to do. Not least of which was facing his father and telling him his wife was dead, that his bastard grandson had killed a satrap, and trying to fend off a conversation about marrying some satrap's daughter in order to patch things up. A conversation Gavin was going to lose. He went to the side of the barge to draft a skull to head over to the other barge. He looked around for something blue to draft from. There was nothing. He looked up. There were no clouds. He was on a barge, on the sea, under a bright sky. But something was wrong. He tried to draft blue. He was a prism. He could split white light into anything. But nothing happened. A bolt of panic flashed through Gavin. He counted off his colors on his fingertips, thumb to forefinger first, down, then up, sub-red, red, orange, yellow, green, blue. Nothing. He stared at his offending middle finger as if this were its fault. There was no blue. He couldn't draft it. He couldn't even see it. It was starting. Not on the seventh year. Now. He'd never even known how a prism knew when the end began. Now he knew. He was losing his colors. He didn't have 5 years left. It was starting now. Gavin was dying.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of The Black Prism, Lightbringer Book 1. Written by Brent Weeks. Read by Simon Vance. Produced by Tommy Herron. Post-production by Chris Howerton. The Black Prism is also available in print and digital formats from Orbit, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2010 by Brent Weeks. Audio production copyright 2016 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.